Back in the forest, McGrath sat up and absent-mindedly pulled a twig from her hair. A few yards away, the broomstick dropped through the trees, showering leaves. A groan and a small, half-hearted tinkle caused her to peer into the gloom. An instinct figure was on its hands and knees searching for something.
"Did I land on you?" said McGrath.
"Someone did," said the fool. They crawled nearer to one another.
"You?
You?
What are you doing here?"
"Mary, I was walking along the ground," said the fool. "A lot of people do. You know what I mean? I know it's been done before. It's not original. Probably lacks imagination, but, well, it's always been good enough for me.
Did I hurt you?"
"I think I've got one or two bells that won't be the same again." The fool scrabbled through the leaf mould and finally located his hated hat. It clonked. "Totally crushed, i' faith," he said, putting it on anyway. He seemed to feel better for that and went on, "Rain, yes. Hail, yes. Even lumps of rock. Fish and small frogs, okay. Women, no, up till now. Is it going to happen again?"
"You've got a bloody hard head," said McGrath, pulling herself to her feet.
"Modesty forbids me to comment," said the fool, and then remembered himself and added quickly, "Prithee." They stared at one another again, their minds racing. McGrath thought, "Nanny said look at him properly. I'm looking at him. He just looks the same. A sad, thin little man in a ridiculous jester's outfit. He's practically a hunchback." Then, in the same way that a few random bulges in a cloud can suddenly become a galleon or a whale in the eye of the beholder, McGrath realized that the fool was not a little man. He was at least of average height, but he made himself small by hunching his shoulders, bandying his legs, and walking in a half-crouch that made him appear as though he was capering on the spot. "I wonder what else Geitha Og noticed," she thought, intrigued. He rubbed his arm and gave her a lopsided grin. "I suppose you haven't got any idea where we are," he said.
"Witches never get lost," said McGrath firmly.
"Although they can become temporarily mislaid. Lonkra's over that way, I think. I've got to find a hill, if you'll excuse me."
"To see where you are?"
"To see when, I think. There's a lot of magic going on tonight."
"Is there?
Then I think I'll accompany you," the fool added chivalrously, after peering cautiously into the tree-haunted gloom that apparently lay between him and his flagstones. "I wouldn't want anything to happen to you." Granny lay low over the broomstick as it plunged through the trackless chasms of the mountains, leaning from side to side in the hope that this may have some effect on the steering, which seemed strangely to be getting worse. Falling snow behind her was whipped and spiralled into odd shapes by the wind of her passage. Rearing waves of crusted snow poised all winter over the glacial valleys, trembled, and then began the long, silent fall. Her flight was punctuated by the occasional boom of an avalanche. She looked down at the landscape of sudden death and jagged beauty, and knew it was looking back at her, as a dozing man may watch a mosquito. She wondered if it realized what she was doing. She wondered if it'd make her fall any softer, and mentally scolded herself for such softness. No, the land wasn't like that. It didn't bargain. The land gave hard and took hard. A dog always bit deepest on the veterinary hand. And then she was through, vaulting so low over the last peak that one of her boots filled with snow, and barreling down towards the lowlands. The mist, never far away in the mountains, was back again, but this time it was making a fight of it, and had become a thick, silver sea in front of her. She groaned. Somewhere in the middle of it, Nanny Og floated, taking the occasional pull from a hip flask as a preventative against the chill. And thus it was that Granny, her hat and iron-grey hair dripping with moisture, her boots shedding lumps of ice,
heard the distant and muffled sound of a voice enthusiastically explaining to the invisible sky that the hedgehog had less to worry over than just about any other mammal. Like a hawk that has spotted something small and fluffy in the grass, like a wandering interstellar flu germ that has just seen a nice blue planet drifting by, Granny turned the stick and plunged down through the choking billows.
"Come on!"
she screamed, drunk with speed and exhilaration, and the sound from 500 feet overhead put a passing wolf severely off its supper.
"This minute, Geitha Og!"
Nanny Og caught her hand with considerable reluctance, and the pair of broomsticks swept up again and into the clear, starlit sky. The disc, as always, gave the impression that the creator has designed it specifically to be looked at from above. Streamers of cloud in white and silver stretched away to the rim, stirred into thousand-mile swirls by the turning of the world. Behind the speeding brooms, the sullen roof of the fog was dragged up into a curling tunnel of white vapour, so that the watching gods, and they were certainly watching, could see the terrible flight as a furrow in the sky. 1,000 feet and rising fast into the frosty air, the two witches were bickering again.
"It was a bloody stupid idea," moaned Nanny. "I never liked heights." "Did you bring something to drink?"
"Certainly, you said."
"Well?"
"I drank it, didn't I?" said Nanny. "Sitting around up there at my age, our Jason would have a fit."
Granny gritted her teeth.
"Well, let's have the power," she said. "I'm running out of up. Amazing how—"
Granny's voice ended in a scream as, without any warning at all, her broomstick pinwheeled sharply across the clouds and dropped from sight. The Fool and McGrath sat on a log on a small outcrop that looked out across the forest. The lights of Loncre Town were in fact not very far away, but neither of them had suggested leaving. The air between them crackled with unspoken thoughts and wild surmisings.
"You've been a fool long?"
said McGrath politely. She blushed in the darkness. In that atmosphere, it sounded the most impolite of questions.
"All my life," said the Fool bitterly. "I cut my teeth on a set of bells."
"I suppose it gets handed on from father to son," said McGrath.
"I never saw much of my father. He went off to be a fool for the Lords of Quorum when I was small," said the Fool. "Had a row with my granddad. He comes back from time to time to see my mam."
"That's terrible."
There was a sad jingle as the Fool shrugged. He vaguely recalled his father as a short, friendly little man, with eyes like a couple of oysters. Doing something as brave as standing up to the old boy must have been quite outside his nature. The sound of two suits of bells shaken in anger still haunted his memory, which was full enough of bad scenes as it was.
"Still,"
said McGrath, her voice higher than usual with a vibrato of uncertainty,
"it must have been a happy life, making people laugh, I mean."
When there was no reply, she turned to look at the man. His face was like stone. In a low voice, talking as though she was not there, the Fool spoke. He spoke of the Guild of Fools and Joculators of Ankh Morpork. Most visitors mistook it at first for the offices of the Guild of Assassins, which in fact was the rather pleasant, airy collection of buildings next door. The assassins always had plenty of money. Sometimes the young fools, slaving at their rote in rooms that were always freezing, even in high summer, heard the young assassins at play over the wall and envied them, even though, of course, the number of piping voices grew noticeably fewer towards the end of term. The assassins also believed in competitive examination. In fact, all sorts of sounds managed to breach the high, grim, windowless walls, and from keen questioning of servants, the younger fools picked up a vision of the city beyond.
There were taverns out there, and parks. There was a whole bustling world in which the students and apprentices of the various guilds and colleges took a right part, either by playing tricks on it, running through it shouting, or throwing parts of it up. There was laughter which paid no attention to the 5 cadences or 12 inflections, and, although the students debated this news in the dormitories at night, there was apparently unauthorized humour, delivered freestyle, with no reference to the Monster Fun Book, or the council, or anyone. Out there, beyond the stained stonework, people were telling jokes without reference to the Lords of Misrule. It was a sobering thought. Well, not a sobering thought, in actual fact, because alcohol wasn't allowed in the guild. But if it was, it would have been. There was nowhere more sober than the guild. The fool spoke bitterly of the huge, red-faced brother prankster, of evenings learning the merry jests, of long mornings in the freezing gymnasium, learning the 18 pratfalls and the accepted trajectory for a custard pie, and juggling, juggling. Brother Jape, a man with a soul like cold-boiled string, taught juggling. It wasn't that the fool was bad at juggling that reduced him to incoherent fury. Fools were expected to be bad at juggling, especially if juggling inherently funny items like custard pies, flaming torches, or extremely sharp cleavers. What had Brother Jape laying about him in red-hot, clinging rage was the fact that the fool was bad at juggling because he wasn't any good at it. "Don't you want to be anything else?" said McGrath. "What else is there?" said the fool. "I haven't seen anything else I could be." Student fools were allowed out in the last year of training, but under a fearsome set of restrictions. Capering miserably through the streets, he'd seen wizards for the first time, moving like dignified carnival floats. He'd seen the surviving assassins, foppish, giggling young men in black silk, as sharp as knives underneath. He'd seen priests, their fantastic costumes only slightly marred by the long rubber sacrificial aprons they wore for major services. Every trade and profession had its costume, he saw, and he realized for the first time that the uniform he was wearing had been carefully and meticulously designed for no other purpose than making its wearer look like a complete and utter pillock. Even so, he'd persevered. He'd spent his whole life persevering. He'd persevered precisely because he had absolutely no talent, and because his grandfather would have flayed him alive if he didn't. He'd memorized the authorized jokes until his head rang, and got up even earlier in the morning to juggle until his elbows creaked. He had perfected his grasp of comic vocabulary until only the very senior lords could understand him. He'd capered and clowned with an impenetrable, grim determination, and he'd graduated top of his year, and had been awarded the Bladder of Honour. He'd dropped it down the privy when he came home. McGrath was silent. The fool said, "How did you get to be a wetch?"
Did you go to school or something?"
"Oh, no. Goody Wimper just walked down to the village one day, got all us girls lined up and chose me. You don't choose the craft, you see. It chooses you."
"Yes, but when do you actually become a witch?"
"When the other witches treat you as one, I suppose." McGrath sighed.
"If they ever do," she added.
"I thought they would after I did that spell in the corridor. It was pretty good, after all."
"Marry, 'twas a rite of passage," said the fool, unable to stop himself.
McGrath gave him a blank look. He coughed.
"The other witches being those 2 old ladies, he said, relapsing into his usual gloom.
"Yes."
"Very strong characters, I imagine."
"Very," said McGrath with feeling.
"I wonder if they ever met my grandad," said the fool. McGrath looked at her feet.
"They're quite nice, really," she said. "It's just that, well, when you're a witch, you don't think about other people. I mean, you think about them,
But you don't actually think about their feelings, if you see what I mean. At least, not unless you think about it. She looked at her feet again. You're not like that, said the fool. Look, I wish you'd stop working for the Duke, said McGrath desperately. You know what he's like, torturing people and setting fire to their cottages and everything. But I'm his fool, said the fool. A fool has to be loyal to his master, right up until he dies. I'm afraid it's tradition. Tradition is very important. But you don't even like being a fool. I hate it. But that's got nothing to do with it. If I've got to be a fool, I'll do it properly. That's really stupid, said McGrath. Foolish, I'd prefer. The fool had been edging along the log. If I kiss you, he added carefully, do I turn into a frog? McGrath looked down at her feet again. They shuffled themselves under her dress, embarrassed at all this attention. She could sense the shades of Gaitha Og and Esme Weatherwax on either side of her. Granny Spectre glared at her.
A witch is master of every situation, it said.
Mistress, said the vision of Nanny Og, and made a brief gesture involving much grinning and waving of forearms. We shall have to see, she said. It was destined to be the most impressive kiss in the history of foreplay. Time, as Granny Weatherwax had pointed out, is a subjective experience. The fool's years in the guild had been an eternity, whereas the hours with McGrath on the hilltop passed like a couple of minutes, and high above Loncra, a double handful of seconds extended like taffy into hours of screaming terror.
Ice! Screamed Granny. It's iced up!
Nanny Og came alongside, trying vainly to match courses with the tumbling, bucking broomstick. Octarine fire crackled over the frozen bristles, shorting them out at random. She leaned over and snatched a handful of Granny's skirt.
I told you it was daft, she shouted. You went all through all that wet mist, and then up into the cold air, you daft bism. You let go of my skirt, Gaitha Og. Come on, grab hold of mine. You're on fire at the back there.
They shot through the bottom of the cloud bank and screamed in unison as the shrub-covered ground emerged from nowhere and aimed itself directly at them, and went past. Nanny looked down a black perspective at the bottom of which a boil of white water was dimly visible. They had flown over the edge of Loncra Gorge. Blue smoke was pouring out of Granny's broomstick, but she hung on, determined, and forced it around.
What the hell are you doing?
Roared Nanny.
I can follow the river.
Granny Weatherwax screamed above the crackle of flames.
Don't you worry. You come aboard, you hear? It's all over. You can't do it.
There was a small explosion behind Granny, and several handfuls of burning bristles broke off and whirled away into the booming depths of the gorge. Her stick jerked sideways, and Nanny grabbed her around the shoulders as a gout of fire snapped off another binding. The blazing broomstick shot from between her legs, twisted in the air, and went straight upwards, trailing sparks and making a noise like a wet finger dragged around the top of a wine glass. This left Nanny flying upside down, supporting Granny Weatherwax at arm's length. They stared into one another's faces and screamed,
I can't pull you up! Well, I can't climb up, can I, at your age, Gaitha?
Nanny considered this. Then she let go. Three marriages and an adventurous girlhood had left Nanny Og with thigh muscles that could crack coconuts, and the G-forces sucked her as she forced the speeding stick down and around in a tight loop. Ahead of her, she made out Granny Weatherwax dropping like a stone, one hand clutching her hat, the other trying to prevent gravity from seeing up her skirts. She urged the stick forwards until it creaked, snatched the falling witch around the waist, fought the plunging stick back up to level flight, and sagged. The subsequent silence was broken by Granny Weatherwax saying,
Don't you ever do that again, Gaitha Og.
I promise.
Now turn us around. We're heading for Lonkra Bridge, remember?
Nanny obediently turned the broomstick, brushing the canyon walls as she did so.
It's still miles to go, she said.
I mean to do it, said Granny. There's plenty of night left.
Not enough, I'm thinking.
A witch doesn't know the meaning of the word failure, Gaitha.
They shot up into the clear air again. The horizon was a line of golden light as the slow dawn of the disk sped across the land, bulldozing the suburbs of the night.
Esme, said Nanny Og after a while.
What?
It means lack of success.
They flew in chilly silence for several seconds.
I was speaking, what's name, figuratively, said Granny.
Oh, well, you should have said.
The line of light was bigger, brighter. For the first time, a flicker of doubt invaded Granny Weatherwax's mind, puzzled to find itself in such unfamiliar surroundings.
I wonder how many cockerels there are in Lonkra, she said quietly.
Was that one of them what's-name questions?
I was just wondering.
Nanny Og sat back. There were 32 of crowing age, she knew. She knew because she'd worked it out last night. Tonight. And had given Jason his instructions. She had 15 grown-up children and innumerable grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And they had most of the evening to get into position. Should be enough.
Did you hear that? Said Granny. Over Razorback way.
Nanny looked innocently across the misty landscape. Sound travelled very clearly in these early hours.
What?
She said.
Sort of an irk noise.
No.
Granny spun around.
Over there, she said. I definitely heard it this time. Something like cock-a-doodle.
Can't say I did, Esme,
said Nanny, smiling at the sky.
Lonkra Bridge up ahead. And over there, right down there, it was a definite squawk.
Dawn chorus. Esme, I expect.
Look, only half a mile to go.
Granny glared at the back of her colleague's head.
There's something going on here, she said.
Search me, Esme.
Your shoulders are shaking.
Lost my shawl back there. I'm a bit chilly. Look, we're nearly here.
Granny glared ahead, her mind a maze of suspicions. She was going to get to the bottom of this, when she had time. The damp logs of Lonkra's main link to the outside world drifted gently underneath them. From the chicken farm, half a mile away, came a chorus of strangled squawks and a thud.
And that? What was that, then?
Demanded Granny.
Foul pest. Careful, I'm bringing us down.
Are you laughing at me?
Just pleased for you, Esme. You'll go down in history for this, you know.
They drifted between the timbers of the bridge. Granny Weatherwax alighted cautiously on the greasy planking and adjusted her dress.
Yes, well, she added nonchalantly. Better than Black Alice, everyone will say,
Nanny Og went on.
Some people will say anything, said Granny.
She peered over the parapet at the foaming torrent far below, and then up at the distant outcrop on which stood Lonkra Castle.
Do you think they will?
She added nonchalantly.
Mark my words.
But you've got to complete the spell, mind.
Granny Weatherwax nodded. She turned to face the dawn, raised her arms, and completed the spell. It is almost impossible to convey the sudden passage of 15 years and 2 months in words. It's a lot easier in pictures. when you can just use a calendar with lots of pages blowing off, or a clock with the hands moving faster and faster until they blur, or trees bursting into blossom and fruiting in a matter of seconds.
Well, you know.
Or the sun becomes a fiery streak across the sky, and days and nights flicker past jerkily like a bad zoetrope, and the fashions visible in the clothes shop across the road whip on and off faster than a lunchtime stripper with 5 pubs to do. There are any amount of ways, but they won't be required because, in fact, none of this happened. The sun did jerk sideways a bit, and it seemed that the trees on the rimwood side of the gorge were rather taller, and Nanny couldn't shake off the sensation that someone had just sat down heavily on her, squashed her flat, and then opened her out again. This was because the kingdom did not, in so many words, move through time in the normal flickering sky, high-speed photography sense of the word. It moved around it, which is much cleaner, considerably easier to achieve, and saves all that travelling around trying to find a laboratory opposite a dress shop that will keep the same dummy in the window for 60 years, which has traditionally been the most time-consuming and expensive bit of the whole business. The kiss lasted more than 15 years. Not even frogs can manage that. The fool drew back, his eyes glazed, his expression one of puzzlement. "Did you feel the world move?" he said. McGrath peered over his shoulder at the forest.
"I think she's done it," she said.
"Done what?" McGrath hesitated. "Oh, nothing. Nothing much, really."
"Shall we have another try? I don't think we quite got it right that time."
McGrath nodded. This time it lasted only 15 seconds. Seemed longer. A tremor ran through the castle, shaking the breakfast tray from which the Duke Felmet, much to his relief, was eating porridge that wasn't too salty. It was felt by the ghosts that now filled Nanny Ogg's cottage like a rugby team in a telephone box. It spread to every hen house in the kingdom, and a number of hands relaxed their grip, and 32 purple-faced cockerels took a deep breath and crowed like maniacs, but they were too late. Too late.
"I still reckon you were up to something," said Granny Weatherwax. "Have another cup of tea," said Nanny pleasantly. "You won't go and put any drink in it, will you?" Granny said flatly. "It was the drink what did it last night. I would never have put myself forward like that. It's shameful."
"Black Alice never done anything like it," said Nanny encouragingly. "I mean, it was 100 years, all right, but it was only one castle she moved. I reckon anyone could do a castle."
Granny's frown puckered at the edge.
"And she let all weeds grow over it," she observed primly. "Right enough."
"Very well done," said King Verence eagerly. "We all thought it was superb. Being in the ethereal plane, of course, we were in a position to observe closely."
"Very good, your graciousness," said Nanny Ogg.
She turned and observed the crowding ghosts behind him, who hadn't been granted the privilege of sitting at, or partly through, the kitchen table.
"But you lot can bugger off back to the outhouse," she said. "The cheek! Except the kiddies. They can stay," she added. "Poor little mites."
"I'm afraid it feels so good to be out of the castle," said the king.
Granny Weatherwax yawned.
"Anyway," she said, "we've got to find the boy now. That's the next step." "We shall look for him directly after lunch."
"Lunch?"
"It's chicken," said Nanny. "And you're tired. Besides, making a decent search will take a long time."
"He'll be an Ankh Morpork," said Granny. "Mark my words, everyone ends up there. We'll start with Ankh Morpork. You don't have to search for people when destiny is involved. You just wait for them in Ankh Morpork."
Nanny brightened up.
"Our Karen got married to an innkeeper from there." I haven't seen the baby yet. We could get free board and everything.
We needn't actually go. The whole point is that he should come here.
There's something about that city, said Granny. It's like a drain.
It's 500 miles away, said McGrath. You'll be away for ages.
I can't help it, said the fool. The Duke's given me special instructions. He trusts me.
To hire more soldiers, I expect.
No, nothing like that. Not as bad as that.
The fool hesitated. He'd introduced Felmet to the world of words. Surely that was better than hitting people with swords. Wouldn't that buy time? Wouldn't it be best for everybody, in the circumstances?
But you don't have to go. You don't want to go.
That doesn't have much to do with it. I promised to be loyal to him.
Yes, yes, until you're dead. But you don't even believe that. You were telling me how much you hated the whole guild and everything.
Well, yes, but I still have to do it. I gave my word.
McGrath came close to stamping her foot, but didn't sink so low.
Just when we were getting to know one another, she shouted. You're pathetic!
The fool's eyes narrowed.
I'd only be pathetic if I broke my word, he said.
But I may be incredibly ill-advised. I'm sorry. I'll be back in a few weeks, anyway.
Don't you understand? I'm asking you not to listen to him.
I said I'm sorry. I couldn't see you again before I go, could I?
I'll be washing my hair, said McGrath stiffly.
When?
Whenever,